Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. Christians have approached the first chapter of Genesis differently over the centuries. There are those who hold to young earth creationism, day-age theory, gap theory, and progressive creationism, just to name a few. Oftentimes, defenders of a particular view will provide biblical, scientific, and historical evidence for their position. Our focus today is on the use of church history to find witnesses for this or that view. Rather than cherry-picking a quote here and a quote there, it's better to read ancient Christians in their own context to be sure we are interpreting them correctly. My guest today is Dr. Andrew Brown, a lecturer in Old Testament and Hebrew at Melbourne School of Theology. He did his thesis on the creation week in Genesis 1 and 2 and has written a book called Recruiting the Ancients for the Creation Debate. In today's episode, he shares his concerns and recommendations for handling our historical sources wisely. Here now is episode 556, Recruiting Ancients for the Creation Debate, with Professor Andrew Brown. Welcome to Restitutio, Dr. Brown. So glad to have you today.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here.
So what got you interested in the creation debate in the first place?
I think I was raised in Christian circles where that was a hot issue. And you're probably aware that at least one of the creationist organizations found its beginnings here in Australia. And so that's been always a live issue in the more conservative Protestant church in Australia. And I think combined with that as an early influence, I think I've always been interested in science. I used to collect minerals and gemstones as a young person and was always interested in things geological. So I always wanted to understand origins in a physical sense and continue to enjoy thinking about kind of earth history and very attracted to that, but also wanting to find a kind of a reconciled mind that is not bifurcated between the Bible on the one hand and what I know of science on the other.
I understand. Yeah. So you don't want to have mutually exclusive spheres of knowledge that never touch each other. You want to be an integrated, holistic individual. That's admirable. I think that makes sense. Sometimes I get frustrated with the critical scholars who do their scholarship, like on the historical Jesus, for example, and then they have the Christ of faith. And I'm just like, but you're one person. Like, what are you doing? But I hear what you're saying there.
Yes. When you are pastorally engaged with people and, you know, like you, I've been a pastor at different phases of my life. Some of these artificial moves just won't wash with real Christians.
Not with real people. Yeah. Yeah. You can sort of try to silo everything, and then they ask that one penetrating question that cuts to the heart of the matter. So this book, Recruiting the Ancients for the Creation Debate, is not written in a vacuum. It's seeking to solve a problem. Can you talk about the problem that you see in the creation debate that this book is seeking to answer?
Yes, so it really tackles one aspect of the creation debate, and that is really the quest for authority. And the quest in particular to go back into Christian history and find the great interpreters, the great thinkers, the great theologians, and kind of harness them when this is being done badly, to harness them for the cause, usually on the cause of literal interpretation of the creation accounts or else against literal interpretation, you know, for a figurative interpretation, but a little bit too quickly, you know, a cherry-picking attitude to try and grab some outstanding figures for my cause against the opposition, and sometimes just list their names in a stack. I've got Augustine and Calvin and Luther on my side, or, you know, if Augustine was still alive, I'm pretty sure he'd agree with me. Mm-hmm. And so in part, it's a plea to do the historical side of that better, to be better historians and to allow these admittedly really important figures to make sense in their own context. And that involves a bit more hard work of understanding that context and then not just grabbing a soundbite from their texts, but really trying to understand what their texts are doing in their situation. So better hermeneutics and better historiography.
Yeah. Seems like you've been influenced a lot by apologetics, even though that's not really your field. Your book is seemingly a corrective to bad apologetics, I guess, is what I'm picking up.
Yes, that's right. And I get impatient sometimes with poor apologetics.
Yeah.
Yeah, which even comes out in my teaching role here and my colleagues. We sort of encounter that from time to time from students who think they've really got a crushing argument that ends all debate. And often we feel that there's some reason why it's not quite such a conclusive argument. But really, we don't want our apologetics to override our integrity in dealing with the witness of the past and the great interpreters of scripture. We really want to let them say what they're trying to say, first of all, and try and understand why that makes sense in their context. And really come to terms with the fact that these questions change and these contexts change. And maybe some of the things that leading figures from early church history are talking about, maybe they're simply not our issues anymore.
Yeah.
And yet we can often find wisdom that survives across the ages because these great figures have stood the test of time. They've proved to be really significant and profound.
Yeah, yeah. I like where you land in this idea of visiting as opposed to recruiting. You actually use the word lasso at one point, which I thought was hysterical. And it's just sort of this vivid image of wrapping your rope around somebody in antiquity and just yanking them into the modern time to testify on behalf of your particular theory of interpreting Genesis 1. It strikes me as somewhat unusual that you, being an Old Testament scholar, have done so much work on church history. These are two fields that don't typically join hands. What sets you on that course?
Yes, this does have a fair bit to do with the direction that my supervisors steered me in way back when I was doing my PhD studies at the University of Queensland. It's funny, I think they were a bit afraid that I was a fundamentalist, and they steered me, I think, initially in a history of interpretation direction to create, I think, what they felt was another degree of safety in what I might come out with in my PhD, so that I would be standing back and observing a bit more and not kind of doing too much damage. But I'm not sure that they had read me right there. But I really loved the exercise in the end of discovering the history of interpretation, because it has a way of really contextualizing your own views of what's going on. And it really became a study in different periods of history of some of the great trends. It became for me a sample of the history of science, you know, the rise of the modern sciences and how that happened in the European context. Mm-hmm. So it was genuinely interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
And I think of my course of research as existing at the boundary of Old Testament studies and biblical hermeneutics, history of science, history of philosophy, and these current discussions about origins. So,
yeah, arguably apologetics as well. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So I do feel that that is quite an interdisciplinary academic existence. But this is actually an era when, you know, everyone's trying to get out of their silos and create breaches between them. So it's actually a rather timely time to be interdisciplinary in some ways. Yeah. But it does have the challenge of trying to achieve competence in multiple fields. And it's hard enough to achieve competence in one academic field.
Yeah.
It's dangerous to think that you can do it across three or four sometimes. Yeah,
well, I mean, even just within history, the people who do patristic history versus medieval, Reformation, or modern, you know, these are all different, totally different fields within church history, which is its own separate field from Old Testament studies, you know. And then you have the philosophy of science, or history of the philosophy of science, or something like that, which is really its own thing too. So you've had to do an immense amount of reading. If I'm to believe your approach in this book, which is stop cherry picking, read big chunks, then I'm thinking that you have read big chunks. And so this is a very time consuming and laborious approach. I wonder if you could speak about method a little bit. How did you sort out your research project to arrive at what you accomplished here?
Yes. So this second book was more focused in certain ways than the first one. The first one was attempting to be comprehensive, and I got the feeling almost that I was a little bit like those astronomers whose new telescopes can see a lot more universe, and yet knowing that the observable universe is limited by the speed of light in this expanding sphere. And really, this research felt like that. You're pursuing the cutting edge of research, but it's retreating from you faster than you're capable of pursuing it. But the second book, the fact that the figures mentioned needed to feature as authorities in the creation debate allowed me to restrict myself to better known figures and then to try to focus on them more carefully and master them better. So there was a selective principle at work there that helped me and also made sure that relevance remained a criterion here. You know, so this is more about the people that people have heard of rather than the obscure and interesting side figures.
Yeah, which, just going to be real transparent here, I appreciate.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
I appreciate it when people do scholarly work on those who have influence in the world in which I currently live. Obscure individuals from history are fascinating as well, but they often haven't had a bearing on how people especially argue these kinds of questions, rightly or wrongly. So obviously we can't cover the whole book in this conversation, but I wonder if you could just dip your toes into the anti-Nicene period, you know, just that first little chunk, and tell us, what were Christians saying about creation? What way could you summarize that a little bit for us?
Yes, I think when you get to know those early figures, you early on realize that they're not asking the kinds of questions that we're asking. They're really not very interested in the rise of physical creation for its own sake, the way that even I myself am, and in a way our generation is. So when they read early Genesis, they're often reading for establishing Trinitarian relations or Christology, interested in Christ's role in creation, but not really interested in the history of physical creation, but thinking ontologically, thinking in terms of the categories of reality, not much of a sense of the flow of time, but certainly how do we end up with a physical world? And, you know, Christ as the Logos, really in Colossians 1 sort of terms, undergirds reality, is kind of the realization of the plan of God for existence. And so then, you know, the incarnation of Christ is the final great act of the Logos, you know, to be enfleshed in this world that is really attributable to the Logos. It's this Logos through whom God realizes a world and then kind of incarnates himself within it. Yeah. So it's not about, you know, how the hills formed and or, you know, trends in development of flora and fauna. It's really establishing philosophical and theological categories. So we have to come to terms with the fact that they're just not asking the questions we're asking. But one recognizable question that does kick in over the first couple of centuries, is there a substrate, an original base matter that is the substance with which God creates, or is even that impinging on the kind of distinction of God from the created world, and should we speak about creation out of nothing? So that takes a little while to kick in, but by about, you know, the third century, we're talking about creation out of nothing. So people would recognize that.
Yeah, I remember reading some of this randomly showing up. I wasn't reading for the purpose of the creation debate or whatever, but I remember encountering this word coeval, C-O-E-V-A-L, and that being very important to them. What's that all about? That creation is what, the same age as God or eternal? Why did that matter?
Yeah, so it was basically a question of whether there was one eternal principle or whether there were two. And even though someone like Justin Martyr, a very early figure, was just comfortable to talk about a primordial matter that God could create with, and it even seemed as though one spot in Wisdom of Solomon admitted that existence, as theology was clarified and they were contending with dualist philosophies, you know, ideas that there were twin principles from the beginning and so forth, it was felt important to really emphasize, no, that there is nothing that kind of competes with God's status by sharing his eternity. And so everything that's not God must be kind of profoundly originate, you know, profoundly non-eternal, including matter. Yeah.
Would you say then that this idea of creation ex nihilo didn't really come up until a little later? When did that come up?
Yeah, so Justin Martyr in the middle of the second century is not really concerned about it, but it's beginning to be clarified on the cusp of the third century there. So, yeah, start of the third
century. And that's with the Alexandrian school? Or who were you thinking of in the third century?
Yeah, well, I think you see a change Tertullian between Justin and Irenaeus.
Okay.
But I think from memory, a quite early figure, Theophilus of Antioch, was already talking about creation out of nothing from memory.
Interesting. Since you're an Old Testament guy and you probably know way more about this than I do, I wonder if you could give a couple comments on Genesis 1:1 in reference to the whole issue of in the beginning God created versus when God began to create. You know, I looked at you're a Hebrew guy. So like, I looked at that Hebrew, like I don't see any indication really for this like subordinate clause approach, but I like it. It's interesting. And I take off the shelf my Jewish translations of the Old Testament. It seems like they all go for the subordinate clause intro. Mm. And so I'm just wondering if you can help me with that a little bit.
Yeah, it's quite challenging because, you know, the accenting of that verse there's language evidence going two different ways. The construction is not quite like anything else that's out there. We would normally expect in a subordinate construction with a phrase in like Bereshit in the beginning, we would expect that to be followed by an infinitive. Okay. You know, in the beginning of something to happen, you know, in the beginning of this action or that action defined very non-finitely. So it's unusual to have what looks like sort of an adverbial phrase, Bereshit, followed by this definite verb. So the Masoretic accent system actually puts a disjunctive under Bereshit as if it stands alone, and that tends to support this absolute rendition.
Okay, so in the beginning God created that.
Yes, correct. Yeah. There is the nearest language example to this is early in the book of Hosea, I believe it is. I think it's Hosea 1:2, where it talks about the beginning of Hosea's prophetic ministry. And it doesn't use Bereshit, but it uses Tehillah, another word for beginning. And the construction is quite similar. I'd need to read it carefully to, I won't try and take it from memory, but that's the best analogy.
Tahilat, Diber, Adonai, or Yahweh. So,
right. So you'll notice that it uses a finite verb, like Genesis 1:1, you know, Diber.
Interesting. So you think the grammatical evidence is more on the absolute side that is pretty typical among Christian translations?
Yes, I do think it's a standalone statement, and that goes with a sort of a discourse understanding that I think here we have an initial summative statement prior to the narrative unrolling. Yeah. So I understand that one verse summarizes all the action that's about to follow in the remainder of chapter one. Okay. So that's kind of a discourse comment.
Yeah. Talk to us about this millennial approach, like the cosmic week. What's that all about? And
this is fascinating. This ties into the way that early Christian Bible interpreters really tended to think typologically about everything, that they expected to see correspondences between different things, in keeping with the fact that readers of Revelation, which was a little bit of a contentious book early on, you know, in canonical terms, the fact that they were seeing, you know, a 1,000-year millennial kingdom there in Revelation 20, and then statements like a day for the Lord is like 1,000 years, you know, which is quoted in 2 Peter 3 from the Psalms.
Yeah.
That led some Christian interpreters, particularly the more kind of material millennium people, to expect or to understand that each day of the creation week was an enigmatic hint at a sort of an unfolding program for the ages. Now, something we have to clarify that's become clearer in the last 50 or 60 years is that it was a long, long time before it was seen to describe six separate millennia of human history and then a millennial kingdom. For a long time, the 6,000 years were viewed as a lump in particular. Now, the problem in a way here was that if you were operating on a Septuagint timescale and you had a creation around about 5,500 BC, given the numbers in the genealogies in the Septuagint in early Genesis, then you had Jesus arriving seemingly quite suitably in the middle of day six of, you know, at the 5,500-year mark. Yeah. So that seems suitable. But as patristic history unfolded, you began to face the prospect that you were getting towards the end of day six and you might expect something eschatological to happen.
Yes.
And now this means that the more allegorical interpreters, such as Eusebius, one of the motives in establishing their chronology, or Eusebius establishing his chronology, was that he actually establishes a shorter pre-Christ timescale that runs back to 5,200 BC in his chronology, which actually takes all the eschatological heat out of expectation in his time and projects a return of Christ, if it were to come at the end of 6,000 years, quite a few centuries into the future. So this has been pointed out by a guy called Michael Landers, these patristic efforts to damp down kind of apocalyptic enthusiasm, you know, cool off expectations that people can expect Jesus in a generation or two. So obviously that was a bit of a live issue for the early church, the way it sometimes has been for the modern evangelical
churches. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure you see it from time to time. I certainly do, where some author will write a book and predict the end, or some YouTuber or whatever. And being a pastor and dealing with real people, I tell you, it is amazing to me how frequently they will say, oh, so-and-so just predicted the end of the world. And I'm like, haven't I preached on this like enough times that like everyone who's ever predicted this has been wrong so far? Don't listen to this knucklehead. He's just trying to sell books, or he's sincerely deceived. Either way, it's not good for you. And, you know, these waves, they just come one after another after another. And I do feel your frustration with this whole debate. But at the same time, it's also heartening to know that people are looking forward to the coming of Christ. That this is still something that's very much alive and in Christians' hearts around the world. So, yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying there. I'm thinking of the Epistle of Barnabas, was it, that had the – was that the earliest one with the – 6 days and he'll come on the seventh day? Yeah, it's an interesting theory, but it's not biblical. So I don't think we're beholden to it, at least those of us who are, you know, of the Protestant mindset.
So it kind of had two lives, right? It had a life off the back of the dominant Septuagint chronology that the early church was operating with, where creation was 5,500 BC-ish. And so it had a kind of a hot period leading up to about 500. And then Jerome was actually responsible largely for the fact that young earth creationism today is operating from more like a 4,000 BC chronology, as he turned attention back to the Hebrew, you know, away from the Septuagint as the basis of the Latin Vulgate. That really meant that, you know, as you approached the end of the second millennium, you know, the year 2000, you were back in another hot zone of kind of expectation.
Thanks a lot, Jerome.
At the time, you know, probably thought he was solving a problem.
Oh man, that's funny. What about the Alexandrian school? Could you comment on their approach?
Of all the groups that are not really interested in the unfolding of physical history of creation, that's very much the case there. And so
very
Origen
allegorical.
Is such a big mind that we all need to get to know him. You know, he proved controversial in the long run, and I think was operating on such a high plane that a lot of ordinary believers probably found him hard to follow, I would imagine.
Yes.
But he famously said, you know, about the days of creation, along the lines of, you know, who that has a brain in their head is going to think that these are literal days and that there was actually light, you know, three lit days before the sun was created. He kind of couldn't believe that anyone would really take it that way.
Yeah.
And more basically, the Alexandrians, and then this influenced Augustine and others, were thinking it's pretty dishonoring to the glory of God to think that God actually needs 7 days to create. The problem for the modern thinker is that 7 days isn't kind of long enough to produce the appearance of history that we see built into the rocks and so forth.
Yeah.
But for them, it was really a theological objection to 7 days being not too short, but too long, right? You know, why would the all-powerful God need time to do things?
Yeah, and pop it into existence. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Huh. So look, the flow of time just was not a big factor in their thinking at the time.
All right, let's move to Augustine. I like to say that he's the most influential Christian after Paul in the first 1,000 years. I don't know if you would agree with that, but he's just,
yeah, pretty much.
His influence is just ridiculously powerful in his own time, but, you know, enduring, because I really think of Luther as a turn back to Augustine and Calvin as well. So like I feel like his shadow is still casting even in our own time. But what was his take on it? Maybe you could just offer some remarks there.
Yes, I think this is the creation stance that we most need to know about from the patristic era. And I agree with you about the significance of Augustine. He's the great synthesist of the church, resolves a well-thought-out systematic position on so many doctrines, you know, like the Trinity, a theology of history in the city of God, and sure enough, creation as well. He starts out offering allegorical interpretations of the creation week to refute Manichaeans. So he comes out of a Manichaean background, you know, he's a Manichaean adherent for 9 years or so. And one of their takes on the Bible is to mock the literal meaning of what they read in narratives like creation. And so his first tactic is to interpret the details there allegorically as a sort of a small target tactic. But he is not actually satisfied with that, because he returns to the creation account more than once as if drawn to a more concrete interpretation that doesn't simply allegorize the details. Where he lands is in one of his great works, The Literal Meaning of Genesis, completed over quite a period of time. He concludes that he does need to handle this text literally, but a literal handling of the days of creation proves to be that this symbolizes for us stages in the cognition of creatures higher than us, angelic creatures, recognizing the plan of God in its ideal form and then in its unfolding. So his literal days of creation, literal phases in an instantaneous creation. And so he's really significantly influenced by this Alexandrian position.
And Neoplatonism, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. And he really can't conceive of why you would need chronological days, but they must mean something.
Yeah.
And so he understands the evening morning cycle to be different levels of awareness of creation. You know, there's a sort of a darker awareness where you understand something in its physical phenomena, like a scientist would. But for the Neoplatonist Augustine, a higher kind of knowledge is to grasp the reality of something in its ideal substrate, you know, the plan behind the physical manifestation. To grasp that is a higher thing. And then the third stage is to turn that awareness to worship of God. And that's really a theme across several of our creation interpreters in the course of church history, is really that to grasp creation aright is just a little like the mere edges of his ways in Job 37. It's a way to actually grasp something about the nature of God himself. And that enhanced perception really should result in worship. So that might be something of value we can take from, you know, you can say that about Basil, you can say it about Augustine, you can say it about Calvin, that even the humblest awareness of the realities of the world can be an inspiration for our worship.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Psalm 19, day to day pours forth speech, and, you know, the creation is declaring the glory of God, you know, and I think there's a similar move in Romans 1 about creation's testifying about God's invisible attributes. It seems like a very, very important aspect of the whole reading of the creation account that we basically just miss today. It's yes. Like using it in a sense of devotionally or as part of worship. Perhaps the closest I could think of off the top of my head is an Australian song from Hillsong, the So Will I song. Do you know that one?
Yeah, I think so.
That was a really interesting meditation on creation. Yeah, I thought that was very well done. I enjoyed that.
So I think...
go ahead.
One of the things I think about the way creation often manifests in the mind of the believer who's, you know, feeling threatened by evolution or what have you, is that there's a need to sort of man the barricades. And basically there's a defensive kind of thinking. And in lots of ways I kind of understand it. There are plenty of scientists out there who don't mind the occasion to, you know, disparage Christian naivety and what have you. There are reasons why people feel defensive, and just an instinctive sense that these different explanations for the world tending to exclude one another. But I actually think this worship attitude can make the whole topic of creation not something that arouses all of our defensiveness and self-protection as if we're in retreat, but can actually change our mindset so that we can hop out of our trenches and realize, as servants of the God who undergirds and authors creation, we're kind of on the winning side that way, right? We don't have to try and hold on to our last trench. We've been introduced to the God that is the source of all the beauty and order in the world. And I just think that should create a fundamentally optimistic attitude in us, that there is no point digging trenches if you intend to keep moving forward.
Yeah, I wonder what your opinion is of like John Walton's approach to Genesis. Is that something you broadly agree with, or you think is misguided, or what's your take on it?
Yeah, so I think that it's good to incorporate this idea of function into our understanding of what a creation narrative is going to try and explain in the Bible. One thing I would say is that ancient Near East creation stories in general are often trying to explain not just how the physical planet and its vegetation and animal life came into being, but really how does the world that we know today come into being? And it tends to incorporate human society and technology and things like that, that they form part of a creation story. Now, there's already a bit of distinction happening in early Genesis, because the rise of technology is taken outside of divine origins and made the responsibility of human beings in Genesis 4 and going on. So there's actually a pretty modern kind of distinction between the rise of civilization and the rise of technology in contrast to ancient Near East stories. But I think we're being presented with a world that's made functional for living in, that's made life friendly. And so that has a functional aspect. I think John Walton's right in that regard. Where I think he's taking a bit of a small target approach is to say that the creation week narrative, you know, the hexameron, is really purely about function and is not saying anything about sort of the structure of our world. But there is a physicality to it when you read it. It's laid out in very broad categories. So, you know, as broad as you could just about get them, you know, here's things that are in the sea in two or three categories. Here's things on land in three or four categories. Very, very broad. You could say very versatile on that account, but it's not aphysical, right? It's sort of not purely about functionality and nothing to do with physicality. So I think when I try and read like an Israelite would have read, I can't eliminate physical origins as if it's not a concern.
Yeah. So perhaps he offers an overcorrection, taking the pendulum all the way over to function when there's maybe something of both to be appreciated there.
That's right.
So I wonder if you could synthesize for us. I mean, we obviously can't get to the rest of the book. People will have to get it if they want to know about the Middle Ages, about the Reformation, about more modern times. But I wonder if you could synthesize for us how you look at it in a brief way. You know, I won't interrogate you, but you are rather coy in the book. So we'll see how you are in the flesh.
Yes. Yeah, I do come across as rather coy. I'm sort of a fair degree of a non-concordist in my approach to early Genesis, in that I don't think it's saying a lot to us about physical process. Given that I think that the creation week itself is a literary device, and you know, my earlier studies showed that it was a familiar storytelling device from the Baal cycle in Ugaritic literature and other ancient Near East stories. You know, so when these stories talk about the flood, they don't talk about a 40-day flood, they talk about a 7-day flood. And the ship in the story lodges on the hill, you know, on the climactic seventh day of a 6 and then a 7-day series. So this device of something going for 6 days and then reaching its climax on the seventh day is a familiar trope in ancient Near East literature, particularly in the languages close to Hebrew. And so I too think that theologically actual literal days would be rather redundant, but I like C. John Collins' interpretation of the creation week as an anthropomorphism, much as we see different kinds of anthropomorphisms in the second creation episode with, you know, God molding humans like a clay pot, right? If that's not an anthropomorphism, I don't really know what is. The rest of God on the seventh day, you know, you get to Exodus 31, and it doesn't just say that he ceased, which is how you could interpret Shabbat in Genesis 2:1-3, but it actually says he rested at the end of creation and was refreshed, got his breath back, right? So there are lots of anthropomorphisms around the ways of God in creation, because human beings, especially, you know, back from this first intended audience on, needed the work of God represented in human terms, like a human building project, if they were to understand what was going on. So someone like Calvin has a very clear teaching about how God accommodates his communication, Augustine too, how God accommodates his communication to the needs of human beings at the time. And so I think that speech of the creation week and the kind of timing we get out of that is accommodated speech to allow people to understand in some way God's work of creation. But if we actually want to find out the history of physical creation and how it unfolded, I think we're going to need to go to the natural evidence of the rocks and the genetics and see what actually took place.
Okay.
I think one thing that's often a crux for Christians is that, a bit like our Alexandrians, they imagine anything that God in his great power does must be done instantaneously or very close to instantaneously.
Or directly, like, without
everything you'd expect all the work of God to be a miracle.
Right.
But in fact, if we believe, and I think this is a critical doctrine, that not just as a human species, but that you and me and our people that we talk to pastorally and so forth, every saint sitting in the pew is the creation of God. If that's what we believe, and I think we can establish that from Job and Psalms and other places, then what we're saying is God does sometimes do his creative work gradually and by means of natural processes. The right. consequence of denying that is to deny that you and me are creations of God, and then that has all kinds of negative ramifications for our self-image and how we view ourselves in God's world. So I think we need to say that we are creations, and that establishes that God does some of his good work gradually and using means and not always directly and instantly.
Very good. Would you agree that it's key to read any ancient literature, but especially, you know, we're talking about Genesis, in light of the first people who would have been the audience? And, you know, that if you take that step, then the sorts of questions you ask are different of the text. And that's kind of like the key to unlock the hermeneutical, you know, understanding.
Yes, that's right. So I do really like, for its efficiency, that saying that John Walton will sometimes express, not to us, but for us.
Mm-hmm.
And just remembering, I really, really have to read this text as something that was addressed to a group of people who existed much earlier than me and in a very different cultural environment. And I'll never perfectly understand what that difference means, but I've got to start to try.
Yeah.
Or else I'm really operating out of the kind of arrogant paradigm that the most important audience God could have had in mind when he created this scripture was me and 21st people like
century
me.
Australians, of course.
Boy, it's kind of arrogant.
yeah. To a large degree, the success of the Bible, to some degree, the success of the Bible for many of us, I think, is how direct it feels. It does feel like it's speaking directly to us. I mean, think of Augustine's tol lege moment in the garden, right? He picked it up and he read from Romans and he was like, oh, this is speaking to me. And so there is something about that, but it does land you in hermeneutical shipwreck because you end up misinterpreting and not recognizing the historical context. So it's really a both and, I think.
Yep.
I appreciate your
to us, but not for us is a nice balance, right? You know, it still captures that idea that scripture can continue to live, and that basically divine authorship means it can continue to.
Right. There is a sense in which the Spirit is at work even today as we read.
Great.
Do you have any projects you're working on now? Do you know what's next?
Yes, I often find myself working on teaching projects, which I'd love to do a little more research than I do. So I've just taught early church history for the first time in this past semester, and I'm still
it's a great class. Years did you cover?
Up to the Council of Chalcedon 451.
Oh, yeah, 451. So yeah, that's a good, yeah, that's fantastic. Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did. Yes. I still found myself having that interdisciplinary experience of backfilling things I should have read years ago in that area, you know. But
I've taught that class several times, and every time I'm just like amazed at how much I don't know. Every time it's just like, okay, I need to learn more about this, or I need to learn more about that. And there are monographs on all of it, you know, like whatever you want to study, there's so much depth. That's great. So how can people follow you and learn more about you? Do you have a website or anything like that?
So I'm on LinkedIn, and I have a faculty page as part of MST's website, which is very simply www.mst.edu.au academia. And I have a dormant website called firstthreequarters.wordpress.com, which just needs some attention, really.
Very good. Very good. And your teaching is really just at the school, or you have anything on YouTube as well, or anywhere else?
Yes. So there'd only be the very odd thing on YouTube. But I actually have a lot of my teaching prezis out there. I don't know how.
Oh yeah. Prezi. Now.
Yeah. I've used prezi a lot in the past for teaching purposes. So I've just made them available. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sean.
Well, that brings this episode to an end. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 556, Recruiting Ancients for the Creation Debate, and leave your comments, questions, and feedback there. In our episode from last week, was Paul really subverting Caesar with Clint Burnett? A number of people have commented in, some on Facebook, some on the website. Robert commented in saying, I'm having a hard time with this one. There seems to be some great disagreement about the nature of the Roman imperial cult. Your guest says there's no such thing, then goes on for 15 minutes explaining how all these imperial cults operate. Just because there isn't a centralized office sending out official orders doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
It's like saying there was no Revolutionary Army during the late 1770s because there wasn't an official government yet. Well, I think we might have had our wires crossed a little bit here. What Dr. Burnett is doing is saying there, first of all, is no centralized official orthodoxy, I guess, for how cities and provinces and individuals should give divine honors to the emperors and their families. That came through clearly. And Robert, you say this yourself in the comment. What is his main point? What is his complaint? Well, here's his complaint. His complaint is this lazy overreach that tends to be the case on this subject, where we'll take an inscription from one place and say, this is how all people in the Roman Empire thought about this thing. And that's just not good historiography. That's just not a good approach to material remains or archaeology. When you find an inscription, it tells you what the inscriber and whoever paid for it and whoever could read it were thinking. It doesn't tell you what everybody was thinking, and you can't homogenize. I think we've just gone too far in homogenizing. Now, there are some homogenizable factors of the Roman Empire with respect to this topic, and certainly in Burnett's book, you'll see that he does this too. He will say, well, this is a general understanding we find throughout Greco-Roman cities and especially Roman colonies, where they were very dialed into the way things happen in Rome. And I think his nuance is a necessary corrective, a necessary pushback, basically holding our feet to the fire, saying, look, stop it with the decoder rings. Just because an inscription says the word gospel and applies it to the birthday of the emperor doesn't mean that every time anybody says the word gospel in an inscription or in literature, they're trying to undermine Caesar. Or the same thing with the word Lord, where you do have this later on. His former book, which I haven't read, talks a lot about how the word Lord is used in the Levant. So the region of Israel and the surrounding countries, of course, in those days, it would be called Judea and Syria and so forth. That whole general region, the Semitic region, would use the word Lord of kings, but not of gods. So that's really an interesting thought as well. But then to universalize that and say, well, they're calling Jesus Lord. Well, that means that they're saying Caesar is not Lord. Well, they don't say that. So you're reading that in. And, you know, if you can make the case that inscriptions or other literature regularly refers to Caesar as Lord, then yeah, you can start to build a case for that. But that's not really what we find in the historical record. So I think that's really what's going on here with Burnett's approach. Honestly, I think you should read the book if you're interested in the topic. Brandon also wrote in saying, hey, Sean, can you clarify the consequences of altering what we think about Paul's focus here? What do the two camps lead us to conclude? So Brandon, probably the biggest issue Burnett debunked was, as I just mentioned, reading it to Paul, calling Jesus Lord, like in Philippians 2:11 and 1 Corinthians 8:6. Those are two hot-button scriptures. Philippians 2:11 is the part at the end of the Carmen Christi where Paul says that every tongue is going to confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God the Father. It's a very elevated way of saying the word Lord. I think it would be, honestly, the most elevated way of saying the word Lord. And then in 1 Corinthians 8:6, it talks about how there's one, for Christians, there's one God the Father and one Lord Jesus Christ, whereas in Corinth, there are many gods and many lords. These are exegetically significant passages, and you can easily start thinking, oh, well, yeah, he's saying that Jesus is the true ruler of the world and not Caesar, but that's just reading it in. I think that's Burnett's whole point. That's not really what Paul is up to. Paul wasn't actively seeking how to subvert the Roman Empire's ideology of applying divine honors to Caesars in a subversive political way by applying those same so-called technical terms to Christ. No need for a secret decoder, as I've been saying. Paul is doing what he appears to be doing. He's communicating theology and ethics to the churches as needed. He's not really worried about Caesar or concerned about divine honors given to him. Pagans worship their idols, whether old gods or deceased Caesars. It's wrong. Paul knows it's wrong. His churches know it's wrong. except for maybe in Corinth, there were some that were attending, going to some meals in sacred spaces in pagan temples, which seems to be confirmed in 1 Corinthians 10. But like, and even in that instance, there's no separation of like worshiping the ancient gods and worshiping the Caesars. I just don't think it is a worthwhile focus for Pauline studies. Now, if we want to talk about Revelation, the last book of the Bible, I think you can make a point that there is a lot of political subversion there, and that that would be an interesting conversation for another day. And I think Dustin Smith has done a lot of work on the sort of political overtones in the book of Revelation, and so has Preston Sprinkle in his recent book Exiles, and others as well. Certainly the commentaries on the book of Revelation will do that. So that would be something interesting to think about. But our goal here at Restitutio is to restore authentic Christianity. And if we're under the impression that there are these specialized words and phrases that are doing something over against Caesar, and they're not, then just understanding that corrective, I think, is valuable. Well, that's going to be it for today. Thanks, everybody, for writing in. If you'd like to support this ministry, you can do that at restitutio.org. Thanks to all of you who are. We'll catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.